This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 79 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing the philosophy of color in Star Trek. And just to make sure we have this right, Mike, this is not the philosophy of race. This is philosophy of color in the ordinary sense. You know, like red shirts and gold shirts and blue shirts. Ordinary color. That's what we're going to talk about today. Color in the Star Trek universe. What does color have to do with philosophy? We'll find out shortly.
We'll find out. I'm going to find out, Zachary. This is not something that I am terribly familiar with. As you and I talked in the Turbo Lift, I have studied color from more of a artistic, psychological standpoint. I took heavy art courses when I was in high school in anticipation of going off to art school to get a commercial art degree, which I didn't do, obviously. I went on to go to Bible college and seminary to get a theological degree. So my perspective on this is more from an art psychology, color psychology, psychology of color. Of course, I worked for many years in the advertising industry, and again, we use the psychology of color quite a bit in the commercial arts fields.
I think what I love about talking about color from a philosophical standpoint is color is one of these things where you really have to convince people that there's even a philosophical problem that's worth taking seriously there. On the surface, obviously, you look around and there's color around us. Like, you're wearing a colored shirt and I'm wearing a colored shirt, and we see people wearing colored uniforms in Star Trek, and color is part of the world around us. But when you dive in a little bit and you start asking the question, well, what exactly is color? And, you know, how do these external objects in the world produce colorful phenomena in our consciousness? And how exactly does that work? What's the causal chain? And what exactly is color in some abstract sense? It's remarkably difficult to give a satisfying account of color that doesn't leave some dangling threads and leave a bunch of things unexplained. And pretty much any attempt you can give to try to fully explain what color is leaves something out. And that's why color is an interesting topic philosophically. But again, it's kind of one of these topics that you really have to convince people to take seriously. Obviously, there's color. Well, yeah, and I don't think anyone's really denying that there's color. It's a question of what it is and trying to give an analysis of color that explains everything that needs explaining about color. And that's remarkably difficult. And then we'll talk about color inside the Star Trek universe, because obviously, I think when people think of color in Star Trek, before we get started talking about color and philosophy, what do you think of as like the most colorful image in Star Trek? For me, the image, when I first started thinking about this topic, color in Star Trek and the philosophy of color, the image that jumped in my mind are the colored uniforms from the original mm-hmm. series, because the original series is such a bright, bold, colorful show compared to a lot of shows that were on at the time. And again, that's not really relevant to anything philosophically. That's just the mental image I had of color in Star Trek were the original series uniforms.
Yeah, the original series was conceived and shot in the 1960s when color television was really, to some degree, a new thing. So, you know, bright, vibrant colors were something that they used quite frequently, and it was very much a part of the story. art directors for these shows put a lot of thought and a lot of effort in the colors to select to convey something in the story. So you can learn a lot about, you know, who the villains are and who the good guys are. And you can learn a lot about the people from looking at the environment and the colors, and not just the colors, but the lighting that they use to really accentuate colors, how they use lighting to convey things like romantic feelings and evil intentions. It's really fascinating to look at it from that standpoint. But when I think about the most colorful image in Star Trek, I've got to go to the motion picture. I just, in my mind, seeing the 1701 refit going to warp.
So when I think of the 1701, the movie 1701, the refit Enterprise, I think of that bright blue glowing deflector dish.
Yeah, but I think about that incredible spectrum of color that's used when the ship goes to warp. When I think about colorful images, I still see that refit going to warp. And that incredible spectrum of color when I think about colors. And then, of course, we all think of red shirts, as you mentioned at the top of the show. Those poor guys, you know, wearing red, always dead. You know, those guys. So, again, how they tell a story and how they use color to tell that story. It's fascinating.
So I feel like we need like a go-to example, like the one canonical example of color in Star Trek that's an actual object, so we can talk about an object having color. So things like the deflector dish glowing, things like the warp, you know, the warp trail glowing, those aren't actual objects, right? Let's talk about just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, colorful object. A red shirt is a great example of a colorful object. Sure. In Star Trek. I'm happy to use that as our go-to example.
Let's use that as our go-to example. I don't think they get enough credit. I mean, these guys, they lay down their lives for the ship and for the captain, for the crew. I think this podcast should be dedicated to the red shirts.
I can kind of imagine the red shirt's perspective on this. Like, I laid down my life putting on this red shirt, and all I got was a mention in this lousy podcast.
Yeah, someone would buy that on vacation or something. I can see that.
So now that we have our go-to example, a red shirt in Star Trek, a colorful object, we need to ask, I think, the most fundamental question. Is the redness that we see in a red shirt a physical property of that object itself? Does the red shirt possess the color red in some way? Or is there some other interpretation of where the color red lies? I feel like there's two options. Either the redness is in the shirt in some way, and the shirt is red, or the redness is in our consciousness, and it's not a physical property at all. It's more like a mental object in some way, a mental entity, an abstract mental entity. And there are really kind of two options there. Where exactly does the redness, insofar as redness exists, unless you want to deny that red exists altogether, kind of fictionalize it away and just say it's a clever way of talking about some lower level physical phenomena, but where is the redness? And that's a very difficult question to answer because there are two possible options, right? Either the shirt is red, and that's a physical property held by the shirt, or redness is in my mind in some way. And it doesn't seem, and it seems like those are kind of mutually exclusive. It can't be in both places if there's this thing, redness, in the universe. Well, which is the most plausible direction? I think that's remarkably difficult right off the bat to even know which way to go with it.
Well, it's interesting, Zachary, because we do have some science to fall back on in terms of explaining where the redness comes from in terms of dyes and refracting light and so on and so forth. But then there's also the science of how we see color. And I actually have a couple of friends who are colorblind. So if we were to pull them in on the podcast, they might have some interesting points to make in disputing whether or not color is a thing. One of my friends, in fact, can't see anything in that spectrum of red. So
he's red shirt blind?
He's red shirt blind. Absolutely.
Well, you basically gave two options, two different ways we could go with this conversation. One way is to talk about the physical explanation of color properties and color vision. The other option is to talk about the subjectivity of color. And I think insofar as we want to try to ground an analysis of color in something objective, like what is color really objectively, not our subjective perception of it, we should probably start by going the first route. Let's dive in to talk about what the physics of color and see if that really gives an adequate answer to what color is. So you mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned objects have, they reflect light at certain frequencies and mm-hmm. certain amplitudes. Different frequencies we are recognized by our perceptual apparatus as having different color. So if you kind of dive in and say, let's talk about what the red shirt is made of. It's made of certain kinds of atoms and molecules that reflect light in a certain way. And that accounts for why it emits certain wavelengths of light, right? You know, along the color spectrum. But if you dive in and look at that kind of micro analysis of the physics there, right? What is a wave of light? Well, what are its properties? It's got frequency, it's got amplitude. Mm-hmm. You kind of have the dichotomy between particle and waves. We know the sort of quantum nature of light nowadays, but if you look at the fundamental properties held by the wavelengths of light that are emitted from the shirt, or not emitted, reflected from the shirt, none of those seem colorful, right? If you're talking about a waveform that has a certain frequency and a certain amplitude, I wouldn't say the waveform is red, right? The waveform has amplitude,
right.
And it has velocity, and it has a frequency, and it has whatever else you can say about the particles or the waves of light themselves, right? Whatever you can measure about it. But none of those things are red, right? A waveform is not red, and the amplitude of the waveform is not red, and the velocity of waveform is not red. So where exactly does the redness come from? And I think that's kind of the potential unfruitfulness of that line of reasoning, is that you're kind of essentially explaining away the redness of the red at that point, because none of the things you've mentioned are red.
Okay, I'm following you at this point. So then it becomes a matter of what the color is as seen through the eye of the beholder. And I think that there's some really interesting conversation that we could have there in terms of physiology of alien species in Star Trek.
Well, I think that's interesting because, you know, we as humans is approach this from our human standpoint, right? We know what human color vision is like. Even on this planet, we don't know what animal color vision is really like, although we can kind of analyze their rods and cones and their mm-hmm. eyes and have some sense of what it might be like to, you know, perceive like my cat. My cat has a different number of cones than I do, so it doesn't see color as well or something to that effect, right? I don't know what that's really like. I can kind of imagine it. But in Star Trek, we open ourselves to thinking of creatures that have radically different sensory apparatus than we do, right? So it'll be fun when we get that far to think about what that means for the philosophy of color and whether that makes an impact in anything we're going to say. But I do think we should kind of continue this micro analysis, because we're kind of pushing the answer back, right? Okay, if the wavelengths of light and the physical properties of whatever light is, whether it's a particle or a wave or some wavicle, right, some combination of the two, however physics spells that out, if that doesn't explain what red is, the redness of the red shirt in Star Trek, right? Always, you know, if you take a tricorder and you sort of hold it towards the red shirt, and you're going to measure all the physical properties of the red shirt, you're not going to see red. You're going to see all these lower level physical properties, the things the tricorder can measure, right? Those don't explain why the shirt appears red to us. So you gave another potential answer, which is, well, it has to do with our sensory apparatus, the way the light interacts with the retina on our eye and produces nerve impulses along our optic nerve, and that goes into our brain and makes some neurons fire, and boom, we see color, right? So I think the fundamental question is that any more satisfying of an explanation than trying to explain it in terms of the wavelengths of light alone? Because you can go, well, okay, so the wavelengths of light, imprint on my optic nerve and cause some sort of physical reaction in my optic nerve, sends these nerve impulses into my brain, some neurons fire. Mm-hmm. And does any of that seem red either?
Exactly.
And I think that's the fundamental problem, is none of those things seem to have this property of redness either. You can kind of micro-analyze them in terms of physiology and biochemistry and all the things that are going on along that causal chain from the light entering my eye all the way into my brain, right? But none of those things seem to capture redness either. Yes, the end result is red, but that's the thing we're trying to explain. Why does all of that produce redness, you know, the thing I perceive when I look at the shirt, as opposed to just some, you know, lower level physical description of, you know, this causal chain leading to my brain? But where does the redness come from? Why does that result in red?
Well, and again, what's fascinating is it's all through the eye of the beholder. And we have this conversation occasionally in Star Trek where, and I'm thinking of Enterprise, Phlox is examining a Suliban and he's talking about these genetic enhancements that have been added to the Suliban that he's examining. And he makes a point of saying that this Suliban has the ability to see far beyond anything that a human or, for that matter, a Denobulan would be able
like
to see.
Like infrared or ultraviolet.
He's talking about the EM spectrum, you know.
The entire EM spectrum.
So
he doesn't need a radio receiver. He can just receive Morse code through his eyes.
So what does that say about how that Suliban, for instance, I mean, since this is the red shirt edition of Metatrex, what does that mean to that Suliban when he encounters, and we know that there aren't red shirts per se in Enterprise, but let's say, suppose that this Suliban were to encounter a Tos Era red shirt, what does he see? That fascinates me.
Well, I guess the question I have is that helpful at all in explaining what color vision is? Because I can imagine what that would be like. Okay, so the Suliban has an extended visual spectrum. It can visually perceive frequencies beyond the visual spectrum that humans are able to perceive. Mm-hmm. And presumably that manifests itself in some sort of subjective phenomenon, right? Just like the wavelengths of light when they, you know, enter our eyes and hit our retinas and cause impulse along the optic nerve and cause my brain to wiggle a certain way. I get redness, right? So whatever that is for the Suliban, right? These different wavelengths of light enter their eyes and hit their optic nerve and cause something to wiggle in their brain, and they get a different kind of phenomenon. It may not be, we don't know what it would look like. It wouldn't look red. It would look like something else, presumably, but we have no way of knowing what that would be from our, you know, limited human understanding of color vision. But I guess, you know, it's the same kind of problem, right? How does that physical causal chain produce any sort of subjective qualitative experience of color, whether in a human way or in a Suliban way?
Yeah, and frankly, as I sit here and as we're talking, you know, I can easily wave a hand at all of this and say, this is just philosophy gone amok. This is nonsensical. And I'm sure that we have listeners who are probably listening thinking the exact same thing. And it's easy to do that. But I think it raises some really interesting questions about the nature of color. Now, this brings me back to a little bit of the psychology. Let's think about what we're conveying. Yeah, I find it fascinating that they use red for these expendable crewmen. You know, anytime you walk into a department store, you walk into any department store across the country, and they're having some kind of clearance, or they're clearing out the summer clothes, or whatever's going, you know, 60 to 80% off. And all of that is being conveyed typically by using the color red. It's a high energy color. We know that physiologically speaking, red increases heart rate. It creates a sense of urgency. So retailers are going to use that in clearance sales. I don't know what that says about red shirts other than we're going to clear some out by the end of the episode by wasting a few of them. But again, I think it's interesting, and I think you can do a little line drawing here between the psychology and the philosophy of color.
I guess what I want to do, Mike, I want to create a sort of mystique around color, because color is such an ordinary feature of our experience, and yet we really understand so little about why exactly those particular wavelengths of light produce these particular color sensations when we experience color vision. When I look at that red shirt, why do those wavelengths of light produce what I see as red? Those are two qualitatively different things, right? All the things you can measure about wavelengths of light and all the, you know, sensory, you know, subjective sensory phenomena I get when I observe the red shirt as and see it as red. And those are two such different things. Those two descriptions don't seem to match up. And so what I want listeners to take away from this, I want them to look at this nice, beautiful, colorful world we live in and look at the beautiful, colorful world we see in Star Trek, those beautiful, sparkling red shirts, soon to be damaged red shirts, and really start to wonder why exactly do I see them this way? How does something outside of me, this external object, that when you microanalyze it in terms of its physical properties, doesn't seem to possess this color red that I'm perceiving, how does that produce in me, in my subjective consciousness, this interesting, weird, maybe even beautiful and interesting phenomenon of red and all the physical reactions to red that you just described? That's awfully mysterious when you really start to think about it, and it doesn't match up with our sort of lower level physical understanding of the world. Because as you decompose these physical properties into their more basic components, none of those things seem to possess the quality of redness anymore. So where the heck does it come from? I want to create this mystique around it. And I think there's a danger of taking it so much for granted because it's such an immersive part of our world, unless you happen to be colorblind or unless you're blind in general and that literally have no experience with color perception, that you may not even realize that there's a mystery there to be solved.
You know, Zachary, I'm glad you mentioned blindness. I mentioned at the top of the podcast, I have friends that are colorblind, but I actually... The man in my life growing up was my grandfather, and my grandfather was born blind. So anytime you described something to him, it was really a challenge because you couldn't say something was red. He had no inkling what red was, or blue, or white, or he just didn't see things and understand things and process things in terms of color. So it became challenging. You mentioned how color is such an immersive part of our everyday. You think about it. We do virtually nothing in our day that doesn't involve processing color in one way or another. I mean, we buy a car. We buy it oftentimes we based on color.
Well, and our language, we use our language this way. We say, you know, the shirt is red, right? The shirt seems to have this property. When you start taking it apart, you go, wait a minute, it seems like the red is happening in my consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's not happening there where the shirt is, right? So even our language is a little biased towards this physicalist interpretation of objects possessing a color.
Yeah, and think about the time that we spend matching color, making sure that the tie matches the shirt matches the pants, the shirt and tie match the suit kind of thing, that this process.
Making sure that Captain Picard's uniform matches just so.
Yes, yes. And you know, for me, it's basic brown or black shoes, not really hard to match up. But, you know, for my wife, it's a little bit more of a challenge because you got to make sure that you get the right pair of shoes. You know, the red shoes go with, you know, the red dress or the black dress or whatever. And so, you know, for our female listeners out there, you know, we feel you. We understand what you go through every day and making sure the colors match. And this is just an ordinary part of our experience. We don't even think about it oftentimes in terms of you know, what an abstract concept color is. But, you know, here we are kind of breaking this down. And for my grandfather, there was no making sure the colors matched. He grabbed a shirt, he grabbed a pair of pants, he put them on. If they didn't match, they didn't match.
Do you think Geordi LaForge on The Next Generation cares what color shoes he puts on?
Well, that's interesting that you bring Geordi up, because I was thinking a few minutes ago when I first mentioned my grandfather, we need to talk about Geordi. Because Geordi doesn't see things in terms of color either, even with his visor. The few times that we got to see through his visor, he's not looking at things and processing things by their color.
He's kind of like the Suliban.
Yeah.
With his visor, he can perceive a wider swath of the electromagnetic mm-hmm. spectrum. He's kind of like the Suliban in that way. So what does that mean? What kinds of phenomena does that produce in him? You know, they try to show it on screen with those kind of swirly color patterns that, you know, when you're kind of perceiving the world through Geordi's visor, it's, you know, it's kind of an artistic interpretation of what that might look like, because that's all you can do on television. But it is interesting to ask, okay, take someone who's blind like Geordi, you know, right off the bat, without his visor, he can't see, much less see color, right? So there are two questions I have. Is the fact that some people can't see color at all, is that helpful in any way, shape, or form in understanding what color is? My instinct is to say that's not relevant, because the fact that some people can't perceive it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. The rest of us still can, right? So it's just kind of an interesting tangent about color vision, that some people don't have the ability to see it. But that doesn't seem to make an impact at all on whether or not I can perceive color and whether or not color exists and what color is, right? It's just, it's an interesting footnote from that standpoint. On the other hand, okay, so Geordi is kind of like the Sulaban, so we can run the Sulaban reasoning with Geordi. Okay, so Geordi's visor has the ability to perceive a wider swath of the electromagnetic spectrum that translates into, you know, impulses along his optic nerve that goes into his brain in some way. Actually, maybe not through his optic nerve. I guess the little connections on the side of his face, right. Do those go to his optic nerve, or do those go directly to his brain? We don't really know.
I think the assumption is that they go to his optic nerve, but I don't think we really
could
know.
We don't really know. I don't know if they ever really spell it out in quite that much detail. Maybe they do, and I'm just forgetting. But in any case, it sure seems to produce some sort of phenomenal awareness, right? Either it's vision like we think of vision, or it's vision that's a little different than we think of it. You know, something along the lines of what they show when we're, on cameras trying to perceive things through Geordi's visor. Or it's some totally different kind of phenomenon that is unique to Geordi that is different than what you and I have altogether. But in any one of those options, I think you have the same exact problem. No matter which interpretation you choose, how do these lower level physical properties produce subjective phenomena, subjective experience of whatever, whether it's color as we know it, color as we don't know it, or something totally different? I think you have the same exact problem with Geordi as you do with humans. I don't think that's helpful in understanding what color vision is and why it exists at all in this world that seems to be based on, made up of things that are described in very quantitative terms, you know, velocity and mass and frequency, those things you can measure. How does that produce subjective experience? Even subjective experience is radically different potentially as Geordi's.
Zachary, it's this really interesting tandem that's happening here between these lower level properties and this biophysical, physiological kind of intake that happens with the perceiver of these lower level physical properties.
Yeah, resulting in sensory awareness, subjective awareness of what seems to be a qualitatively different type of thing, right? The redness of the red, the perception of the red, is so different than all the things you can measure about the red shirt.
Exactly, which may give us some insight as to why those poor red shirts die in this in the rapid succession that they do. Perhaps the alien species that keep gunning for them aren't seeing red at all. Perhaps they're seeing something that causes a neurochemical reaction in them, this fight or flight, and they just, you know, they just fire.
Can't help themselves. So I think it would be interesting to start diving into some different philosophical theories about color in a very general, sort of friendly way, and see if we can make any progress in understanding what color is. So one way of interpreting what color is to describe it in terms of abstract properties or abstract entities. And we do think in terms of abstract entities all the time. In fact, we have an episode number, right? Our episode number is 79 this time, mm-hmm. right? 79 is an abstract thing, the number 79. And there are a lot of instances of that number out in the real world. Right? There's 79 episodes of Metatrex. There are 79, you know, rocks out in my garden, whatever. There's lots of instances of the number 79. But the number 79 itself is not something you can point to in the physical world. You can point to a numeral, like the written squiggles that mean 79, right? The 7 and the 9 that we would write on a piece of paper or that you see in the episode description when you listen to this podcast. But the number itself is generally taken to be some sort of abstract entity, if it exists at all. If it exists at all, it's not a physical thing, it's an abstract thing. And it has certain properties. It has properties like the number 79 is the property of being odd as opposed to being even, mm-hmm. right? That's a property of the number 79. So you could try to spell out what color means in terms of abstract entities. So if I look at the crew of the Enterprise and they're all assembled in the recreation deck and they've got their different colored uniforms on, you can go, okay, well, there's some number of blue shirts and some number of red shirts and some number of gold shirts and some number of, you know, pick your favorite, white shirts if we're talking about the if we're talking about the motion picture from a little bit ago, right? There's some number of those, and they all seem to have something in common. All the blue shirts seem to have this property of blueness in common, and all the red shirts seem to have all the property of redness in common. All the gold shirts seem to have the property of gold in common. well, what accounts for their having something in common, right? What do they share? Just like the number of our episode, 79, and the number of rocks in my garden, 79, they kind of partake in or share in this abstract entity, 79. You could say that, well, as opposed to the individual blue or red shirts out there in the recreation deck, there's the abstract entity, blue, and the abstract entity, red, and the abstract entity, gold. And the individual objects that are those colors, the red shirts and the blue shirts and the gold shirts, are somehow instances of this abstract entity, blue in the abstract, red in the abstract, gold in the abstract, just like the number 79 is an abstract entity.
But just as this podcast and the rocks in your garden, Zachary, have virtually nothing in common, perhaps, than just the number 79, it's plausible to say that, for instance, the blue shirts or the red shirts or the gold shirts have nothing in common except their blueness, other than the fact that, and since we've moved from red to blue now, blue typically connotes within the Star Trek universe someone whose expertise is in the sciences. Now we have assigned color to distinguish between sciences and name whatever other discipline or field a Starfleet officer might work in.
So I like this example of a bunch of red shirts standing around. We've got not just one red shirt, we've got a bunch of red shirts now, and they have something in common. They're all red. And the question is, well, what does that mean? And I think there's two directions you can go with trying to answer that question. One direction is to say there's some universal thing called red or redness, the universal property or the abstract entity of redness, and that all of these individual red shirts partake in that or share in that or instances of that, some way of characterizing the relationship of these particular objects to this one universal thing we call redness in the abstract, right? That's one way you could go of explaining why these red shirts all share something in common, namely they're all red, right? Another way you could go is to deny the fact that there's this universal thing called redness, even a particular shade of redness, this universal abstract, you know, shade of red. You could deny that and say there is no such thing as red in the abstract. All we have is red sub 1 and red sub 2 or red sub 3 and red sub 4 or red shirt sub 1 and red shirt sub 2, red shirt sub 3 and red shirt sub 4. That there's no such thing as red in the abstract or a universal or abstract property of redness. All we have are the individual instances of the redness that we see. You know, red shirt instantiation 1, red shirt instantiation number 2, red shirt instantiation number 3. And that's the end of the story. There is no other facts about redness besides the individual instances of red. What that denies, I think, is why they all seem to look the same. If there really are so many different reds, red sub 1, red sub 2, red sub 3, red sub 4. And we're not talking about different shades of red. We're talking shade of red sub 1, shade of red sub 2, shade of red sub 3, the very same shade of red, but no universal abstract instance of that, just particular instances instantiated in each one of those individual red shirts. If that's all there is, that, to me, doesn't satisfactorily explain why they all seem to look the same to us if they really are qualitatively different things.
Well, again, Zachary, and it goes back to perception and how we see color, but it occurs to me that you can break this down into the properties and waveforms of that red. I mean, there are so many shades of red that I don't even think it's fair to just categorize something and call it red.
Well, that's the thing. I think, you know, you can probably bracket some of this. Like, let's not talk about all different shades of red at once. Let's pick a shade, whatever shade we think red shirts are, mm-hmm. whatever name we give that, whatever, you know, frequency that is on the electromagnetic spectrum. Let's bracket everything else. Let's just talk about that shade of red. We don't even need to talk about something so general as red in general. Although that's a bigger problem. If we have trouble explaining why the different red shirts, which are all the same shade, why they all share something in common, you do have a further problem of trying to explain why all the different shades of red, light red, dark red, crimson red, whatever, why all of those still count as red too. I think that's an even deeper problem with color vision besides trying to explain why different objects that share the exact same shade appear the same color.
Yeah, because I have this conversation with people all the time because I have studied art
I love that you have this conversation with people all the time.
I do, because they'll say to me something general like, hand me the red one. Well, wait a second. Which red one? There are just the red one there. No, there's red, and then this one's ruby, and this one's maroon. And so, you know, you begin to make these distinctions between red. And again, it all goes back to perception. So it just begs the question, you know, what is red, red by any other name?
Well, I think there's a lot we can bracket there, right? There's different shades of red. Let's bracket all the ones except for the one we're talking about, right?
A red shirt by any other name, Zachary.
Red shirt red. That's the name of it, right? Whatever shade that is. Let's pretend all the other shades of red don't exist for the purpose of this immediate discussion, right? Why do all those different red shirts, right? Red shirt number one, red shirt number two, red shirt number three. It's probably how they're given in the credits. Red shirt number one, red shirt number two, red shirt number three. Why do all those different red shirts appear to us the same way if they're different shirts? You know, yes, they have the same frequencies in common. We're looking at them with the same sensory apparatus. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't explain the commonality to them, I think, right? You could imagine a situation where the different red shirts produce different phenomena. You know, in us, it's hard to really know what that would be like. Like, okay, for example, let's suppose, in fact, this is probably a good time to dive into sort of a classic thought experiment in philosophy of color, the inverted spectrum thought experiment. It's conceivable that there exists some humans or maybe some aliens out there in the Star Trek universe that perceive color in the opposite way that we do. Their color spectrum is reversed. What looks to us as red looks to them as blue or purple, right? The other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So a couple of problems here. Why do these different shirts all look the same color? First of all, you know, if they're different shirts, you know, what accounts for their commonality, even amongst that one shade of red, bracketing all the other shades of red? And then why do they appear red as opposed to some other phenomenal interpretation of that wavelength of light? You know, you could imagine a being, an alien in Star Trek that perceives that frequency, but doesn't see it like we see it. It sees it as blue, for example, a blue shirt. And it thinks the blue shirts all get killed, but because it lives in a social environment, it's learned to use language the same way we have, and it's sent subspace messages with humans. It says it knows to point that out and say that's red. You know, it will correctly identify the red shirt as red, but really perceives it like we perceive blue.
I knew Kirk should have wore his green tunic when he went to fight the Gorn.
Yeah, it would have made all the difference.
It would have made all the difference. The Gorn would have saw him as friend instead of foe.
Instead, he saw him as a red shirt.
You raise an interesting point, and we sort of alluded to it earlier when we talked about how other alien species might perceive the color. And we understand we're talking about these lower level properties of the color itself and how it's perceived by the person who is receiving the image. And so other alien species, and for that matter, we can go to Star Trek Voyager when we go to this monochromatic universe and we have these aliens who are monochromatic, who see everything black and white. They're from a different dimension.
They don't believe color is real. I love that they don't believe color is real.
They don't believe it's real. Exactly. And we talked a little bit about dimension. I believe it was back on Metatrex 58, Transdimensional Slices, when we discussed dimension with Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager here on the network. And so, you know, do we pull apart the fabric that separates our dimension from another? And are we in a dimension where color can't exist?
So I think there's at least a couple of things we can say here. One is that if it's possible in principle for a species with a totally different sensory apparatus to perceive the exact same wavelength of light and perceive it in a different way, a different kind of phenomenon, or even with Geordi, I think you could run the same example with Geordi, given his different sensory apparatus with his visor, but take the Suliban or take an alien that, you know, perceives the same wavelengths we do, but perceives them as different phenomena, as different what we would call different colors. Does that immediately mean that there's more to color vision than just the basic physical facts of the objects that have a certain color and the wavelengths of the light they emit. It seems on the surface you could say that means there just has to be more to color vision than the mere wavelengths of light.
Well, let's speculate for a moment, shall we? Let's look at some of the common alien species in Star Trek. And let's begin with the Romulans. When we see Romulans in the Star Trek universe, their wardrobe, their sense of style, their dress, everything about the Romulans that we see is very monochromatic. Things are even lines in their blacks, their silvers, their grays. And that seems to be...
It's at least an aesthetic preference, if not a genuine difference in their sensory apparatus in terms of how they perceive color.
Yeah, so yeah, again, yeah, exactly. What does that say?
That's a beautiful shade of gray, you know?
Exactly. And so how do they perceive color? Maybe they don't, and maybe that explains the lack of bright, vibrant color. And we know, let's step out and, okay, we're using color to convey something. We're back to the psychology of color and how it's used in the Star Trek universe by the directors, by the producers, by the showrunners, and so on. But let's put ourselves in universe. It's interesting to me how that might inform us of something unique about, in this case, the Romulans. And we can do this for every species in the Star Trek universe.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things that are interesting. You mentioned the aliens in Voyager that are monochromatic photon beings. They don't, believe...
Photonic,
yeah. Yeah, photonic beings. They don't believe that color is real because they just know this monochromatic photon-based existence. So they see these objects in real, in living color, as we would call it, and they just don't believe it's real, right? They kind of deny the existence of color. You're kind of heading a similar direction in talking about the Romulans and their preference for cool colors and grays and things like that. Maybe they're not monochromatic, but maybe some sort of subdued color vision. But I guess the direction I see you heading in the conversation is that one possible answer is just to deny the existence of color altogether. And I think this is one possible answer. You can say, well, look, we have this word red, and we have these quasi-subjective phenomena of seeing red, but we can reduce that all away. You know, given what we know about physics and about light these days, we know that what we call red is just a certain wavelength of light interacting with our optic nerve a certain way, producing a certain kind of thing going on in the brain, and that's all there is to color. There is no extra special thing called redness. We've just kind of microanalyzed it away. So yes, we have this word red, and we have these, it sure seems like we have a perception of red, but there's no thing called red above and beyond all the physical stuff we just described, the properties of the object and how it reflects light and the wavelengths of the light and what that produces in our optic nerve and what that causes in our brain. That's all there is to color vision, and that's the end of the story. And any attempt to, give color a more robust existence than that is going to fail. And what you're essentially doing is kind of explaining color away. Like, well, yeah, we have this word color, but really color is just all this lower level stuff. And so color doesn't really exist above and beyond anything else we've described. So you could actually just blatantly deny the existence of color. Like, color doesn't exist in any way above and beyond all the physical stuff we just described, and that's the end of the story, and there's no other things to color besides that. I think the hard pill to swallow with that approach is that it denies literally what's before our very eyes. It sure seems like looking at red looks a certain way. It doesn't sound like it's identical to any of those lower level physical things we were talking about a little while ago. So I think the hard pill to swallow, if you want to kind of microanalyze color in terms of physical properties, is you have to kind of say, well, all that subjective phenomena is not as real as you'd like to think it is. And I think that's a really hard pill to swallow when every time we open our eyes, for those of us that have normal color vision, see color all the time. So it amounts to denying literally what's right before our eyes. So I think it's a hard line of reasoning to follow.
Well, exactly. And again, if we go back to the two ways that we split this up, we talk about these lower level properties, but then we also look at the physiology of the viewer, the person who is looking at the object. In our example, the red shirt, and how the rods and cones in the eyes react and give us the ability to see these waveforms and make sense of them in something that our brain perceives as color, we have to conclude that the properties that create these waveforms exist. I think we have to come to that conclusion.
I don't think anyone's going to deny that the wavelength, the light itself exists, right? Light is a physical thing that has physical properties.
Sure, exactly. But I think it does raise a very interesting question. So suddenly I can look at my ability to see colors as just that, a property of me more so than just property of color.
And again, I think that boils down to, it harkens back to the very first question we asked, where does color reside? Is color a property of the objects that seem colorful to us, or is color a mental property? Another direction you could go in the direction of, say, emergent properties. Just like we've talked about emergent consciousness before, right? When you take neurons and put them together in a certain way, you get new properties that emerge. Conscious beings that have thoughts and feelings and intentions and desires, this higher level mental description. Maybe color works the same way, that you take lower level physical things, put them together in the right way in terms of how they reflect light and what frequencies of light they emit. And then out of all of that emerges color. It's a little spooky and weird because color is so different than all of those other things we just mentioned, right? The sort of lower level physical basis. But all emergent theory is a little spooky, right? The emergence of consciousness out of neurons is a little spooky and weird when you put it in those terms. The emergence of, say, you can even use a really simple example like water, right? H2O molecules. You take an individual H2O molecule. It's not wet. It's just a molecule. But you put enough of them together in the right way and you get a new phenomenon that emerges. Wetness, like a new property. Wow, that wasn't there before. That's kind of spooky and weird when you put it in those terms. Likewise, you could say, well, color's this just like that. You take, you know, enough matter and light and you put it together in the right way, and then boom, color emerges out of that. And it's a new phenomenon. It's no more or less spooky and weird than consciousness. It's no more or less spooky and weird than the wetness of water molecules when you put them together. And that's all there is to it. It's just an emergent property. Yes, it's novel and it's interesting. It's a higher level property, but it's no more or less mysterious than any of those other things we mentioned.
Yeah, you were mentioning water molecules. I find it fascinating that, for instance, I've seen oxygen in its liquid form, and it sure appears blue to me. So that suggests that there's some property of that oxygen molecule that emits something along the lines of a blue waveform in terms of one of its lower level properties. But again, all of that is in the eye of the person who's seeing it. And really, to some degree, all that I can say is that the only reason that you and I can see the redness of that red shirt and perceive it as red speaks to the commonalities that you and I have as human beings.
Well, I think the assumption that's been driving the conversation so far is that something like redness, the redness of the red shirt, is something that calls for analysis. It needs an explanation. And we've been trying to give various explanations. We've talked about explanations in terms of lower level physical phenomena. We've given kind of biophysical explanations of color perception. We've talked about abstract explanations in terms of abstract properties or abstract entities of, you know, red in the abstract. Maybe the entire effort to give an analysis of something like color is misguided. And this is another theory of color. It's called color primitivism. And it's just the idea that color is not something that arises out of lower level physical phenomena, but color itself is a basic fundamental part of our reality such that you can't actually analyze it in terms of anything lower level. It's just a primitive part of our lowest level of ontology that we use to describe the world, that any attempt to give it an analysis in terms of something else ultimately fails, and we don't deny its existence because it's literally before our eyes. So it must be that color is a primitive lower part of the lowest level description of reality itself. Just deny the fact that it even needs analysis, given that all the different attempts at analysis tend to be unsatisfying.
Something that I think anyone with any level of color blindness would probably dispute.
Again, I sort of just worry that that's kind of a tangent, right? I mean, yes, for those of us that have, you know, correctly working eyes and correctly working optic nerves and correctly working brains, we tend to perceive color. There's variations on that. Some people, you know, lack certain kinds of cones or, you know, have a problem with their optic nerve. I don't know exactly how color blindness works, but it's something along those lines, and they perceive color mm-hmm. a little differently. But and some people can't see color or see anything else for that matter. But I think those people are just plain a little irrelevant to the discussion, because clearly, I mean, the fact that one person can't perceive color doesn't mean that the rest of us can't either. So it doesn't deny that color is real. It just means that person doesn't know anything about it. Lots of things I don't know about because I don't have the experience of them. That doesn't mean they aren't real, right? It's like okay, I'm missing a tricorder, so I can't perceive, you know, whatever you measure with tricorders. Right? That doesn't mean those things don't exist. It just means I don't have the apparatus to measure it. It's like if the sensor array is broken offline. the radiation that you would measure with a sensor array doesn't go away when your sensors go offline. On the other hand, suppose that everyone were colorblind, not just one person off in the corner somewhere. What if all of us were colorblind? Would there literally be no color in that situation?
Well, that's interesting you say that, Zachary, because I was kidding. I literally had it on the tip of my tongue. You described colorblindness as an inadequacy. And
well,
frankly, I
want to be careful there, because I think there's kind of this, you know, kind of hand-wavy philosophical concept of proper functioning in biology. Like, there's a proper yes. function of our various biological features,
exactly.
and that when they're functioning, quote unquote, maybe in irony quotes, correctly, that produces fairly reliable phenomena, right? You know, when our eyes are working correctly, we tend to make correct color judgments, right? So there seems to be a sort of proper function to the way that our sensory apparatus is supposed to work. And some people deviate from that to various degrees, but there seems to be something along the lines of a normal. So normal color vision is a pretty innocuous way to describe normal in biology. But if you start talking about normal function of our reproductive organs, for example, people don't like that as much. So the notion of proper function tends to be a little specious, but it sure seems like with our sensory apparatus, you can make something of a distinction between relatively normal and relatively abnormal in terms of our sensory apparatus.
Yeah, because I find it fascinating as far back as we can go in recorded human history. I mean, from the days that we crushed berries in order to add hues of reds and blues to the things that we painted on cave walls. I mean, literally. It seems that color is something that we as a species have always been able to see and perceive and use to communicate.
As far as we know.
So we make the assumption that this is something that we've always had the capability to do. But I think it's interesting to speculate that perhaps this is an emerging property of our own anatomy and physiology.
Well, you're talking about an evolved trait. It's not something we always possess.
Yeah, a microevolution of our species.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, again, you can kind of ask, well, suppose that there were no color-perceiving beings in existence, not even on Earth, anywhere in the universe in Star Trek, right? Suppose there mm-hmm. were no color-perceiving beings whatsoever. Does that mean that there's no color, or does that mean that there is color, just no one's around to perceive it? It's the old tree falling in the forest shtick from philosophy. But I think you could go two different ways. If color exists in the mind, if it's a mental object, a mental perception. In fact, there's a term that philosophers use for it called qualia, the individual mm-hmm. items of qualitative experience. If there's no color qualia, does that literally mean that there's no color anymore? That's all the color vanished? Or are there still colorful objects, but no one's around to perceive them? I don't think that's clear at all. Again, I keep making these distinctions because I think each one of these distinctions is a little problematic. And that's what's fun about dilemmas like this, is either way you run the line of reasoning, you run into some sort of philosophical trouble. You could just outright deny that color exists, and there's a term for that in philosophy, color fictionalism, that we have this kind of useful fiction of talking about color, but when you microanalyze color, really you kind of reduce it away to do this lower level physical description of whatever's going on in the physical causal chain that leads to what we call color vision, but there's really nothing more to it than that. I guess an interesting question is whether we really should try to eliminate our talk of color and our color descriptions and our language about color, if it turns out that color vision is purely a useful fiction. Should we try to avoid it you know, in favor of talking about, oh, my certain kind of brain fibers are firing in a certain way, or I'm perceiving a certain wavelength of light in along my optic nerve. Like, that's a very nice looking, you know, blah, 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 number of nanometers wavelength dress you're wearing tonight, Counselor Troy.
Yeah, but what fun would that be? Then we wouldn't have red shirts. We'd have expendable crewmen. And what fun is that? Now, you know,
Counselor Troy,
Zachary, what fun is that?
Counselor Troy, that is a smashing looking 70 nanometer wavelength dress. I feel like when you try to explain Keller away, that's kind of what you end up with. It sounds absurd because that's what you're left with. If you really claim that Keller doesn't exist, or you're trying to explain it away in terms of physical descriptions, that's the kind of thing you end up with. There is no such thing as the pretty green dress that Counselor Troy wears on the Next Generation.
I think we missed an opportunity there with Data, quite frankly. we could have gone through in early episodes an entire series of episodes in which he tries to grasp the concept of color.
Well, we know that Data has trouble with feelings and humor, but maybe he also denies color. Like, you know, he's like, oh, I can't perceive green. I just know your dress is 70 nanometers.
That would have been very interesting.
But aren't we all like that? I mean, really, if that's all color perception is, you know, a certain wavelength of light wiggling in a certain way in our optic nerve and causing something to happen in our brain, why does color seem so subjectively different than that description? And I guess that's my fundamental worry, is that color can't just be that, because undoubtedly we do have these subjective qualitative experiences of color. There are obviously color qualia, like the qualitative experience of color. If you try to eliminate that away, I think you're just denying a brute force fact of our sensory experience. And yet, it's like, well, what else is it then? If it's not all those lower level physical things, is it some sort of spooky, weird, abstract entity like numbers and is it, you know, is it spooky soul stuff? What is that? Right? It's hard to know what else it could be besides those lower level physical things, unless you want to go full on abstract entity dualism, right? Where there's physical properties and mental abstract properties. And I think, you know, people who tend to be physicalists, they want to try to, take these higher level phenomena and give an analysis of them in terms of physical phenomena. That tends to leave out the subjective experience, and you know, it's hard to reconcile those two descriptions.
Yeah, it's not very satisfying.
It's not, because it just flies in the face of our ordinary experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Mike, I know I sound like I'm repeating myself a little bit here, because I really want to drive home the mysteriousness of color. I think the mismatch between this lower level physical description and our subjective higher level experience of color as a color, seeing the red shirt as red, not just seeing it as a wavelength of light, or not just understanding it in terms of the biological effect it's having in my brain, but seeing it as this qualitative, subjective, maybe emotionally impactful experience of color, right? That is so mysterious. It's the kind of thing, you could totally take it for granted, right? It's like, obviously I see red shirts as red, but why is this something that even needs explanation? Can you picture maybe Tuvok in his quarters meditating? You know, like, he's got his little Vulcan salute hands together, and he's got the candles lit, and he's meditating. He's meditating on the color. What color would Tuvok meditate on? I'm curious. Would he meditate on red? No, he'd pick a cooler color.
He'd pick a cool color. It would definitely be a blue.
It's like, I'm going to meditate on blue. Because I really kind of feel like this is what's necessary to take this issue seriously.
He had blue pajamas, right?
He did have blue pajamas. Yes, he did. At least what I call blue and what you would call blue.
Yeah.
Really blue, or are they just a certain wavelength of light? No, but really, I'm dead serious here. I feel like in order to take this issue seriously, you really have to think about color. Like, okay, I'm going to think about something that's blue. Let's think about Tuvok's blue pajamas. What are those? Well, they're made of a certain kind of material. And if you kind of zoom in, they're made of atoms and energy, and they're reflecting certain wavelengths of light. Okay, well, are any of those things blue? Not really. Okay, what happens from there? This light enters my eye and hits the back of my retina. Is any of that blue? Not really. Doesn't sound blue to me. Then it causes my neurons to fire, right? Okay, is that blue? Not really. Then all of a sudden, somewhere along the way, at the end of that chain, you get blue. I see Tuvok's blue pajamas. And it's like, that has to strike you as weird when you really take the time to examine that entire causal chain leading up to the blueness that you perceive when you look at the pajamas. There's something weird there that happens at the very end that's not explainable by anything we just talked about.
Yeah, I can picture Tuvok meditating. He's sitting there and he's thinking about his silky blue pajamas. And he's thinking to himself, my rods and cones are gratified by the wavelength of blue in my pajamas.
Now that Data would say that. You just quoted Data. You didn't quote Tuvok. He would say, you know, I've become quite used to the way that your wavelengths of light impact on my, you know, positronic, you know, through my, you know, artificial optic nerve resonates in my positronic brain. And I've become used to the phenomenon. So we're friends. I like your wavelengths. We're on the same wavelength. All right.
What do you think about that? I mean, how would a Vulcan buy clothes? How would, if you sent Data to the Replimat, I mean, how would he select his off-duty casual clothing? Could you imagine Law trying to figure out makeup?
Well, you know, just like you can run this line of reasoning with Data about pretty much anything. Is Data really conscious? Does Data really have feelings? Does Data really perceive color, right? Data is in a great position to understand all the physical facts about color, right? He's read the books, he's done the science, he's accessed the databases, he can perceive the wavelength, you know, down to the, you know, 0.00000000 fill in the blank. You know, at level of accuracy, right? He's got color vision down pat. And then you can ask, does he actually perceive color like we do? And if the answer is no, you could maybe say, well, maybe he knows everything there is to know about color. And that's all there is to color, right? if he does actually perceive color, what causes that? Like, what could cause an artificial being to perceive color? But I don't think that's any more or less mysterious than, you know, why it's than how we perceive color, right? Okay, if Data can perceive color and that's kind of spooky and mysterious given that he's a machine, why is it any less spooky and mysterious that we can perceive color as a color given that we're essentially biological machines that have a little causal chain going all the way from the reflection of light all the way into our optic nerve and into our brain? I mean, that's just as much of a physical description as anything else going on in Data's brain. Well, Mike, we've been talking about color now for about an hour, and I don't feel like we've resolved the issue in any way, shape, or form, but what I hope to have illuminated for our listeners, first of all, I want listeners to take seriously the idea that there's even a problem here to solve. So much of philosophical reflection involves taking something that is seemingly ordinary, that we take for granted, that we perceive and talk about all the time, and recognizing that it's not as simple as our ordinary perception. And I think color is the ideal candidate for this kind of discussion. Color sounds like an obvious thing, like, well, of course the red shirt is red, obviously, right? But when you start diving into what that really means, you realize that it's a lot more complicated than that, at least, and that our assumptions don't match up, and the things that we think we're explaining don't actually explain what we're trying to explain. Like, when you take this physical description of a red shirt, what it's made of, how it reflects light, what its effect on our biology is, how that causes stuff to happen in our brains, none of that really explains the redness of the red that I see when I look at the red shirt, right? And so it creates this mystery. Well, where does this redness come from? And once it's a mystery, then you can start talking about different philosophical options. Like, well, okay, is the redness of the shirt in the shirt? Is it in my consciousness? Is there a universal red, you know, shade of red, or are there just a bunch of instances of that shade of red? Can you take color and reduce it to lower level phenomena, or is color an emergent phenomenon that's not reducible? And there's all these different philosophical distinctions you can make. And what I want listeners to take away is that when you follow any one of those threads, you tend to leave something else unexplained. So no one of those threads is satisfactory in explaining, fully explaining what we want to explain. Namely, is why the hell does this red thing look red as opposed to looking like something else, right? Why the hell does the red shirt look red and not blue, damn it, right? Yes, you can talk about wavelengths of light, but that doesn't explain why you see them as red, all right? So it still leaves something explained. No matter which direction you go in the line of philosophical reasoning, you're leaving something explained and the mystery goes unsolved. And yet, color is such an immersive part of most of our worlds, assuming we're functioning normally and have normal sensory apparatus. If we're not Sulban or we're not Geordi, then color is part of our world, right? So the mismatch between what we take for granted and how hard it is to give a satisfactory explanation of why color works the way it does is continually interesting to me. If you don't find it interesting, you might just go, well, okay, obviously the red shirt's red and that's the end of the story. It may not be a useful philosophical problem. But if you happen to find these kinds of abstract philosophical issues interesting like I do, I think Star Trek is replete with examples because Star Trek is a colorful show. There's color everywhere in Star Trek. And, sure. You know, if part of Star Trek's mission is to give an account of the universe, to go out and, you know, explore and increase our knowledge and seek out new life and new phenomena, then explaining color has to be part of that, right? That's part of understanding our universe from our point of view, is why the hell do we perceive the universe in the way we do? You know, we've got a sensory apparatus. There's a bunch of stuff you can measure out there in the world, and that produces the things we subjectively perceive. And that is interesting that our subjective perceptions can emerge out of this physical universe that we live in. If you don't find that interesting, I'm not sure what to say. I think that's inherently kind of interesting and mysterious, but you could take color so much for granted that you don't think there's a mystery there to be solved. But, you know, philosophers who think philosophy of color is interesting will kind of stomp their feet and, you know, shake their fists and say, no, 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 there's a real problem here, I promise. And I feel like that's kind of where the discussion of philosophy of color is at, that you kind of have to convince people to take it seriously. And then once you do, it's pretty easy to see that it's a much harder problem to solve than it looks like it should be. Even given as much as we know about the physical world, and as much as we know about light, and as much as we know about physiology, and as we know about neuroscience, color is still a mystery in terms of why we, you know, sort of visually perceive the subjective phenomena that we experience as opposed to some other subjective phenomena. When we perceive color. So I hope it's been interesting. I think Star Trek is a colorful show and it lives in a universe that's just like ours, and they're on a mission to explain things just like we are. So I hope that our examples of red shirts hasn't been too tedious as we've spent an hour talking about something as obvious as the redness of the red shirt.
Yeah, I don't think I've had too terribly much to add to this discussion, because this is a very abstract topic, and it's something that I haven't spent a lot of time really thinking about or working through. But I will say that I find it fascinating, because you can start to reduce these things down when we're talking about color, and you can break this down and begin to question, okay, where the heck does it come from? And, you know, you can look at it in terms of these lower level properties. You can look at it from more of an ability of our own anatomy and physiology, and begin to reduce it down and ask some questions. But, you know, at the end of the day, the only question I'm really finding myself asking, if I've just been assigned to the 1701, and I mean the 1701, no bloody A, B, C, or D, and I come aboard and the quartermaster assigns me a red tunic, is a red shirt by any other name? That's the only question that I have, Zachary.
Did you ever see the movie Ants?
Yes.
Do you remember when the queen is popping out the baby ants and they go, worker? You know, they kind of assign it a role. You think that's how it works? You get assigned to the Enterprise and they're like, red shirt, gold shirt, blue shirt.
Yeah, I'm the guy in the back of the line that's kind of calculating where it's going to fall when it gets to me.
Talk about a class society. Jeez.
I'm trying to trade with somebody. I'm like, dude, trade me now.
Talk about a class society. They're not very egalitarian at all in Star Trek. Once you're a red shirt, you're stuck.
Yeah,
no.
When
so
you're a red shirt,
there's no social mobility when you're dead. A red shirt.
When you're a red shirt, you're dead. It doesn't matter what shade you're dead.
You kind of feel Captain Picard's pain actually when he ends up as a lowly lieutenant with a blue shirt in that alternate timeline. He's like, man, no social mobility, and I'm stuck with this ugly blue shirt. You know, Captain Picard clearly has an aesthetic preference for red shirts. So.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the philosophy of color today, but this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks. Yeah, so Trip, of course, is working to take down Section 31. We as Star Trek fans who have watched all of the shows and read a bunch of other novels know how that's ultimately going to go. But in this story, he's, you know, kind of convinced that Harris is Section 31, kind of the be-all and end-all. He's at the top. It's his own private little army that he's constructed, and Trip is aiming to take them down.
The 602 Club.
And this is happening a lot more in the Star Wars books, and I think it's because it allows them freedom, which is to do books that become character studies. And I think it's very clear that this book, in a lot of ways, is a character study of who this person is and what it is that causes the actions that we see in The Force Awakens to make more sense.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
By getting people like Braga to come on board and work on this show, what they're going to be doing is deconstructing that thing that they did for all those years on Star Trek.
Earl Grey.
Is there anything else we need to add, or do we think that's the...
Are we going to cure Riker?
Oh, shoot, I forgot about Riker. Yeah, sure, fine, we'll keep him around.
Yeah, we've cured Riker. And then for me, this would, or not.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
But check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, no worries, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join the larger conversation is always the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. Again, that's a closed group, but if you click join, one of our admins will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at TrekFM, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Zachary, when you're not trying to come up with ways to perceive the entire EM spectrum, where can people find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Just call me a Suleban. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not busy meditating on the exact wavelength of Tuvok's pajamas, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, they are a lovely blue.
If they're blue at all. Assuming blue exists in the first place.
Assuming the blue
exists. You haven't reduced it away or it's not just a useful fiction.
All assumptions aside, you can find me always on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Certainly you can catch me around the Babel Conference. Would love to talk Star Trek and philosophy with you over there. On Twitter, I'm over there quite frequently. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally around Instagram, cmichael1701. You can always catch my blog about my journey to publish my novel and a little bit about life. You can catch that at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, consider becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm and get all the details. Perks include things like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Where else can you get the philosophy of red shirts? Literally.
Nowhere else out there in podcasting.
Not even metaphorically. Literally red shirts. Only on Trek FM.
Well, Zachary, we'd like to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and One Red Shirt Who'll Never Die. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brendan Shea Mutala. We'd also like to give a thank you and a shout out to our associate producers here at Metatrex. Patrick Devlin, you can connect with Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5 is his handle. Kay Shaw, your co-host over on To The Journey, Zachary, her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble.
Who always looks good in red, I'm just saying.
Our good friend Norman Lau, his Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker in places unknown. Well, Mark, we're looking forward to hearing from you, man, so we can get your contact information in there. We appreciate all four of our associate producers and could not do this podcast without their help and support. We'd also like to thank our sponsors. Enterprise in Space is a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.